Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on how to conduct a risk assessment. Thinking about it this morning, I kind of liken risk assessments. They're kind of like learning how to walk. There really isn't a manual for them, but everyone just kind of has to figure it out for themselves. Fortunately, we've got a great panel of experts who will share their stories about how they learned to walk, and hopefully we can all graduate to running by the end of this discussion. This webinar is being generously sponsored by InterPros. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Leslie Bender has spent more than 30 years handling compliance, regulatory, transactional, and legal matters for hospitals and financial services company. She is currently the Chief Strategy Officer and General Counsel for BCA Financial Services, a Miami, Florida headquartered financial services company. She is a past president of ACA International, serving as ACA's president from 2013-2014, and as an officer on its board of directors from 2011 to 2015. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is general counsel and chief compliance officer for Stoneley Recovery Associates, a debt recovery solutions company. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the RMA International Board of Directors, the editorial review board for the Compliance Professionals Forum, and as a certified instructor for ACA International. She's testified as a small entity representative for the CFPB's arbitration and debt collection rulemakings. With nearly 15 years of IT experience focused on the ARM space, Michael Wright is one of the industry's leading security experts. Wright worked for one of the nation's largest agencies as an information security architect and senior manager before joining TechLock. He has spent the past several years assisting dozens of the industry's leading agencies reduce their IT security risks and improve their security posture and ensure compliance with the myriad of applicable laws and regulations. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage you to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. A recording of this event will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Today's discussion is an audio-only event. There is no video component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. And finally, before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. And the opinions expressed are the opinions of the speakers and not their independent organizations. And with that, let's start our discussion. Michael, I'm going to give you the honor of the first question, and we're going to kind of do things maybe a little bit in reverse. When talking about a risk assessment, maybe let's set the stage by asking you, when wouldn't you do a risk assessment?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here. So when wouldn't you do a risk assessment? I guess the first thing is if you're not sure exactly what you want to get out of it, what your end goal is, you definitely don't want to just start to jump in and look for potential risks. In order to make sure that you actually get value out of the risk assessment, you need to know what you're going in for, what you want to get out of it. Another reason not to do a risk assessment might be if you're pretty busy with other things. If you're already undergoing a client audit, you have a lot of projects going on, you have maybe an incident you have to take care of. If you're doing a proper risk assessment is not only going to take time out of your day, but it's going to take time out of the day of the rest of the stakeholders or participants in your risk assessment. So you want to make sure that you're able to dedicate enough time and resources to make sure that you get the value out of the risk assessment.
And if I could just chime in there, I think that Mike has made some really important, if subtle, points. you know, whether you choose to do the risk assessment yourself, and I think we'll be talking a little bit more about that in the questions to come, or not, you also need to make sure that there is management buy-in to the project. It will involve a significant amount of your internal resources, and if done well, it will result in some findings of opportunities you have to improve your environment. So without management buy-in, it would be a particularly poor time to undertake a risk assessment, knowing that you could be producing a list that either ultimately could be discoverable, should you have litigation that asks you if you've done this, could be discoverable by a client who asks what types of assessments you've done, and you know, certainly would identify some areas of opportunity that for whatever reason you ignored. Probably another time we would want to resist the temptation to do a risk assessment is if we're undergoing a pretty significant corporate change and we have some concerns about some things and we don't have enough bandwidth to remediate them.
Excellent. That's a good way to start the discussion. So now that we've talked about when we wouldn't do a risk assessment, Kelly, when you say when we say risk assessment, it could mean a lot of things to different people. Maybe we'll start by asking you what it means to you and then finish with the rest of the panel.
Okay, thanks, Mike, and thanks for having me participate today. I'm very happy to be here with Leslie and Mike Wright. To me, a risk assessment is a qualitative way to evaluate and prioritize the risks that are there in your organization. It's a process, it's a big process and undertaking by which you look at all of your assets. I mean, everything from your physical office, the data that you hold, because that's an asset to you. Your letters, my collection letters are like my babies. Like these are definitely assets to me. Certainly bring about a lot of risk because you are using them to communicate with clients, I mean, with consumers. Your policies and procedures, all of the assets that you have, you look at the risks that are there and in place to those. The risks by, you know, anything from fire or different, you know, compliance obligations under the statutes that regulate our industry, from the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to the Fair Credit Reporting Act to the TCPA. So you look at all of your assets and you rate the risks to those assets. You also then rate the control measures that you have in place to protect those assets so that you end up with a numeric score showing you the different levels of risk that you have to each asset. And you can put them in order so that you can see your high areas of risk that still exist despite the controls you have in place and your lower areas of risk. And by doing this in a qualitative way, sometimes you will be surprised and you will find that you have something there at a higher risk level than you thought it would be, which means you need to go back and you need to think, okay, what other controls can I put in place to actually lower the risk that I have here, that I'm showing that I have by this qualitative risk assessment that I've done. So this risk assessment is like an integral part of your compliance management system. At my company, we do a large risk assessment once a year where, you know, every year we're adding a bunch of, you know, do we have a new asset? Do we have new compliance obligations based on changes in the state law? And how are our policies and procedures and control measures that we have in place functioning to limit those risks? The other thing I kind of wanted to add later, the first question, because I thought it was important, I'm not sure who else to say it, so I want to say it before I forget it, is about, this is, Leslie was saying, you know, when you're thinking about when you want to do a risk assessment, when you don't want to do a risk assessment, but if you're in a state where maybe you're not ready to create this sort of document, because it is highly confidential and it's highly proprietary, right? You're going to come out with a list, basically, of where you think you might still have high risks to your organization. And so, you are going to have people come in who are auditing your shop that are going to ask to see, are you doing a risk assessment? Because it's a great way to make sure that you're running a good compliance management system. And so I don't let people in my office show the results of our risk assessments to our auditors, even though we might have a non-disclosure agreement in place. I am happy to show them that we go through the process. I'm happy to show them what we're doing, but I'm never going to actually print out a copy of my risks, you know, top 10 risks, and hand it to them. I don't want to do that. That's a practice that we engage in at our shop, and I've never had anyone object to us just showing them what we do and showing them our spreadsheets, as opposed to giving them a copy. So I wanted to kind of throw that in there.
Yeah, that's good point, Kelly. Risk assessment from my perspective is going to be, it's a formal process, you know, obviously as we've been alluding to, typically based on proven methodologies. You may hear different acronyms thrown around every once in a while. NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, has a special publication 800-30. There's ISO 27005. There's Octave. A number of different methods that proven organizations can use to conduct a risk assessment. But, it's not just following through a prescribed set of steps or procedures to follow. The important thing is to make sure that the risk assessment is going to be useful. And what is it used for? If you think about it at its core, the risk assessment is really to facilitate decision-making at the organization, decisions mm-hmm. on what to do based on risks that the organization identifies. And it's at multiple levels too. So, for example, Kelly, you were talking about the different types of assets that organizations might have. You know, your facility is an asset, but your data is an asset too. So there are different levels or tiers, I guess, in your risk management hierarchy to make sure that you include, it's your organization as a whole. It's your individual mission or business processes. But then it's your individual systems or people or applications or data as well. So it's important to make sure that your risk assessment process includes all of those different tiers and that, you keep your eye on the target. It's not just to arbitrarily increase the number of internal controls that you want to comply with. It's really just to reduce risk and provide the business with the information necessary to make the decisions on how they would like to reduce that risk.
And let me chime in there, Mike, on the tails of both of your comments. Kelly mentioned something that I think is very important, which is that a risk assessment is part of your sort of compliance management system. And if you're just getting off the ground and doing your own risk assessment, Mike mentioned some tools that are free that you can download off of the internet. So let's say, for example, that you are servicing accounts on behalf of healthcare organizations. Mike mentioned this special publication 800-30. There also is NIST special publication 800-66, and that tracks to HIPAA's data security rule and lays out a beautiful framework for conducting a self-assessment. So then, borrowing from what Kelly mentioned, you might decide on some sort of risk rating. It could be as simple as high, medium, low. You could do it as a heat map with colors like red, yellow, and green, or you can do a numeric, it doesn't matter. The point simply is to kind of do this assessment that is dynamic. So it's not a once and done, but a dynamic review of either one process, maybe one situation in which things didn't go according to your expectations, or it could be widespread across your whole organization. I think what we would probably all agree and jump in, Mike and Kelly, is that if you don't conduct any sort of risk assessment, fancy, unfancy, according to NIST, not according to NIST, with fancy outside consultants, without them, if you aren't conducting any risk and somebody comes in to kick the tires in your organization and say, here list of things that went wrong and what you did about them. The fact that you don't have an ability to identify and rectify your own mistakes will be a serious problem. A regulator would see that as a problem. Probably a client onboarding you as a new vendor might see that as a problem. So it is critical to a sound compliance management system to have an ability to both detect and correct your own mistakes. Nobody thinks you're going to have a fail-proof system. You know, I've heard Mike Wright talk before about how you could have perfect data security or secure your data loss prevention program by just locking out all the humans who might have to interact with your system. That may not be a very viable solution, although it certainly would be effective. But I do think that you want to be mindful also of the potential for some sort of regulatory look-see for anybody who is licensed to do business in the state of Nevada. Nevada will do an audit, and they have just beefed up the data security aspect of their audit and have beefed up their data security law. So even if you only have one person in your database who is a Nevada resident, just as you, if you have one person in your database who is a Massachusetts resident, you are expected to have, you know, a compliance program, and that compliance program has to have a way for people to make complaints to you when stuff goes wrong. And probably there has to be a way for people to, you know, log mistakes and the steps you've taken to correct them. You know, certainly the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, formerly known as the CFPB, erroneously, apparently, when a risk assessment was done, would expect you to have this detection and assessment aspect to your compliance management system. So those are just two examples. States like Massachusetts, Colorado, Nevada, they all have expectations about you doing these risk assessments. And, you know, not only do you want to do them for your own benefit, but you want to make sure that you are doing what is expected of you to maintain your licenses in the state in which you do business.
Excellent. Well said. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion briefly, and I'd like to invite Aaron Ryder from InterProach to say a few words. Aaron?
Thanks, Mike. As you said, my name is Aaron. I'm the Director of Marketing for InterProach. We are really excited to sponsor this webinar topic today because mitigating risk is a subject we take very seriously with our web-based software. Our flagship product is called ACE. It's formerly known as WebAR. Some of you may be more familiar with that product name in the past. And we work really hard to educate the market on the safety and security and the significant cost savings as well to collection agencies or departments to take advantage of cloud computing through software like ours. It is our belief, as a service provider to our customers, it's our responsibility to take the burdens of the risk associated with the data security, infrastructure compliance, data backups, document storage, and take it off their plates so that they can concentrate on their business. And let's see, we're using the AWS cloud infrastructure, and we make those investments in time and money for our customers, and we address every risk point we can in that infrastructure and our software. So today's panel of experts have a broad range of topics they're going to cover, from hardware to HR, and we thank them very much for sharing their expertise today. If you want more information on InterProach, please visit our website at interproach.com. It's InterProach.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Aaron, and thanks again to InterProach for sponsoring today's webinar. Before I move on to the next topic, Mike, I just wanted to circle back and follow up on something you had mentioned during your answer to the last question. You were talking about how a risk assessment is not just about sort of following a list of prescribed steps, and you have to make sure it's useful. I was wondering maybe if you could just expand a little bit more on that, and how, you know, and talk a little bit how a collection agency in this case, or you know, a company in the ARM industry, can make sure that you know what they're doing is, you know, it is going to be useful.
Sure, Mike. So you know, the key is to know who's the audience of your risk assessment. Are you going to be using this internally? Are you going to be providing it or the results of it to your customers or your clients? Are you doing this risk assessment out of sort of a general sense of wanting to figure out what your risks are, or are you doing this purely as a result of a statutory or regulatory requirement? The answers to these questions is going to inform you on how you're going to conduct the risk assessment and what you're going to get out of it. It's there are a number of different, as I mentioned before, methodologies that you can follow, but the important thing, which I'm sure we're going to cover in more detail later, is going to be, you know, just to make sure that you have that formal process, that you follow it, and that it covers all the different areas or sections of your business that you feel is necessary to actually conduct your risk assessment against. So I mentioned, for example, that these three different tiers in the risk management hierarchy, there's the organization level, there's the mission or business process level, and then there's the lowest level, which is like the information system or the data element level. It's important to make sure that you identify, you know, the critical assets in all three of these categories to make sure that you can actually get useful output out of your risk assessment.
Can I add on to that a little bit?
Yes, of course.
This is Kelly. I think that one of the ways to be the most useful we've found in our organization is to make sure that you have a diverse group of people participate in your risk assessment. So when we are, you know, rating, the risk to certain assets and our controls, we have the president involved, the director of operations, the director of IT, our director of compliance, and then we take the average. So that way, you get a very good feel for how everyone across the different departments of your organization feels about certain risks to your company. And then it, not only does it help you identify what those risks are, but it also helps you get board support for initiatives that you want to take to shore up those risks. So if you can turn around to your board, or if you don't have a board, your president, you know, or whomever in your organization, you want to buy into something, right? If it comes out that, say, for example, I'm going to use something like super basic here, you have a super large risk to your organization because you're dialing cell phone numbers on your auto dialer, something that would be defined as an ATDS under the TCPA. You have a huge risk to your organization, and you can turn around and show them that, and you can say, this is why we need to go out there and buy a TCPA compliant phone dialing system so that we are not dialing consumer cell phones without their consent on something that's defined as an ATDS. And you can kind of lay out the reasons why using that risk assessment.
I think the diversity that you mentioned, Kelly, is a great point. I mean, if we think about it, a lot of the, you know, we're working on computers every day, right? A lot of our data is stored on or transmitted through these computers. As a result, sometimes, conducting a risk assessment can tend to turn into a little bit more of an IT-centric exercise, when really it doesn't have to be and it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. You do need individuals involved in all areas of the organization, not just IT, to make sure that you're going to get everything you can out of that risk assessment.
I think that's a really important point, Mike, because if we look at, for example, the well-publicized Equifax situation that now, of course, is the subject of class actions and regulatory scrutiny and so forth, one of the things that you miss if you don't have an interdisciplinary team looking at things is that it's pretty hard for us to expect the IT folks in the back room to know what our opportunity costs might be for choices they would make. Mm-hmm. And in the Equifax situation, what was sort of interesting is it was a really happened. There were updates or patches or whatever's the right word. Probably Mike is laughing at me. And the IT team never could get a window where they could put them in without disrupting to some degree operations. Now, I don't know, you know, I'm sure everybody has had the experience that you need to add more licenses, or you need to update your compliance system, or you need to update your collection system, or you need to plug in new peripherals to your system, or you have a new channel for that's doing some type of data analytics or something. There are always reasons where, in order to move forward, maybe you have to take down your systems to update them for some changes that are going to help your business. So there's opportunity cost. So how in the world could a silly lawyer like me or Kelly or an IT guy know what the whole landscape looks like when you make some choices without an interdisciplinary team? So I think it's not just a great idea. I think it's essential that you have those folks, because you may have to horse trade with them over, okay, we'll do this now, and we will, this is what you project to be a low productivity time. That's when we're going to take the system down to put these patches in, you know, and then bring the system back up, so that you get each other's buy-in for different projects of priority to you. I don't know of any company that has the luxury of having a complete replication where they can update, you know, A while they operate on B, and then take down B and operate on A completely. So, you know, those are some things that certainly are going to make a big difference. And who knows, you know, maybe somebody has been out at an industry salesy type conference and starts hearing scuttlebutt about something. If there's not a vehicle for that person to bring that information back to the organization, you know, you could be missing a critical opportunity.
I think in light of what you just said, it makes sense to sort of add right now that one thing you need to do when you are involving a lot of different people in your risk assessment, which is really beneficial to your organization, is to make sure that everyone is on the same page when they are completing their form of the risk assessment. So you need to have either a session where you all get together in the room and everybody takes notes for themselves to remember when they sit down to do the risk assessment, because you don't want to do the risk assessment together. If you did it together, people's opinions would skew what their actual rating would be. So you want to do it by yourself so that you're getting a true compromised opinion of what you know, a risk might be, or how great that control is. But everybody needs to be working within the same definition. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have your director of compliance, who's always alarmed by any threat of risk, rating everything as high as it possibly could be, right? So you want to make sure that you've clearly defined each section and how they're to be rating each section, and what a 5 means if you're using numbers, or what a high means if you're using you know, terms like high, medium, and low, as Leslie was saying. Because then that way you're at least trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page, so that you're going to get the best information from each person, and that you're all working from the same list of definitions, which then, you know, works as like a good control for you.
Let me ask Mike Wright a quick question to follow up on that, Kelly. So, Mike, I've heard you talk in the past about tabletop exercises. To prepare for a risk assessment that you're going to home grow and do on your own, could you do a tabletop exercise to calibrate? Would that work? Have you seen that work?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question. So once you've settled on your definitions, as Kelly mentioned, which is critical. I mean, if you have a specific definition for what you would consider like a high, medium, low impact, or a high, medium, low likelihood of occurrence, and then how you equate that to what an actual risk would be, then following through with a couple of examples, I think, is a really great idea, especially examples that pertain specifically to the business, right? So if you are a collection agency, for example, how would you maybe assess the risk of your letter vendor having a system crashing being unable to process your letters, or your payment processor going down, so now you can't process payments. I think running through some relevant examples just like that would be great to make sure that everyone gets on the same page with the definition that you created.
Yes, absolutely. And that just makes me giggle because it reminds me of when our director of compliance said, well, I'm going to rate that a 5. And then our director of robbery said, well, I'll rate it a 1 to counter that you're rating it a 5. That doesn't help at all, right? So doing a tabletop is a really, really smart idea.
That's funny. Let me come back to you with this question. I know we've talked about it a little bit, but I'd like to maybe say in the context of a couple of different questions or some comments from each of you, but specifically, what are some of the regulatory considerations that you should have in regards to a risk assessment?
Well, certainly they shouldn't be the only thing that is driving you, but there are a number of regulators. For example, if you are doing business in Colorado, Massachusetts, Nevada, then you certainly, New York, you certainly would want to be familiar with what their regulatory expectations are. You can bank on the fact that when Nevada audits you, they now will ask you some pretty serious questions about what your written information security program looks like, your WISP, and they will ask you some probing questions about some of the features, not the least of which is data security incidents. We have seen in the last year a number of states become very, very focused on risk assessments, in particular in the data security context. If you remember the old days where the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, now known as the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, issued its exam handbook, they're very clear about the need to conduct risk assessments and the need to have a very well-documented program. The other regulator that we don't think about very often, but if we are in the healthcare space, we surely should, would be the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They expect, should there be any sort of incidence of data security or other nonconformity, that you're doing some sort of a very well-documented assessment of what went wrong, beginning with a pretty rigorous root cause analysis, so that you are making a fair determination about whether there is or isn't significant risk. So those are just a few examples. If you are servicing for any governmental entity, they will either have FSMA or some other standard. If you are trying to talk about the data entrusted to your care and it has to do with education, you may also need to be doing risk assessments under FERPA. So there are no shortage of standards from regulators. And one of the first things a regulator is going to look at is also how well you assess the risk posed by your vendors. Do you have a good vendor management program? Recalling a moment ago what Kelly said about risk rating, it's probably a good idea to risk rate your vendors in exactly the way she described as well, and consider what type of annual, biannual, every 2 years, every 3 years, you're going to ask them to reassess for you what their risks are in order for you to continue to do business with them.
Yeah, and I think going to those various regulations is a good starting point, like you said. Leslie, you don't want to just rely specifically on those, but I think it's a good idea to at least take stock of them, take inventory of them to make sure that you don't miss anything. The vendor one or the service provider one is particularly key. You've mentioned a couple of regulations like the Massachusetts, the New York Department of Financial Services is another good example where they specifically mention that your risk assessment has to take into account do you take reasonable steps to select and retain your third-party service providers, and do you sufficiently require them to implement and maintain appropriate security controls? in, you know, regarding Department of Health and Human Services and HIPAA, same thing in there. The administrative safeguards part of HIPAA requires you to conduct, they say, an accurate and thorough assessment of the potential risks and vulnerabilities. And they specifically include, you know, you need to not just include the confidentiality and the integrity of the data that you are supposed to protect, but also, for example, the availability of the data so that you can get to it in case you need it. So I think it's a good idea to go through those various regulations, laws, and standards just to make sure that as you build your risk management program, you're taking into account what those regulatory requirements are to make sure you're not missing anything important.
And to add on a little bit there about vendor management, which I'm so glad that you brought up, Leslie, and you just touched on, Mike, is that it is a great way to help you select a vendor when you're in the vendor selection phase, because you need a vendor for, you know, whatever, X, Y, or Z. And you're going to be giving that vendor consumer information that you're entrusted to protect. You need to be basically doing a risk assessment before you even choose that particular vendor. And you probably already are. So just making sure that you're documenting that you're doing that so you can prove that up as part of your vendor management program, right? Because first, before you select them, you want to know that they have the top safeguards in place to protect the data that you're going to give them. So you're going to be asking them a variety of questions relating to whether or not they're PCI DSS or whether or not they're, you know, SOC audited. And then you're going to ask them other questions about encryption at rest, et cetera. And so starting that process before hiring them, then making them commit to it in the contracting phase, where you're going to put those requirements that you're going to audit them, and that if they're not meeting your audit requirements, you have grounds to terminate them if they can't remediate it within a certain time period. And then continuing that process by giving them those same questions again, you know, with the annual review period to see, okay, prove up you're still doing all of these things that you told me you were doing when you were hired. You know, that's a really critical part of the vendor management, because they bring about one of the largest risks to your organization if you are sharing with them consumer data.
Okay, Mike, let me move on and ask you, you know, we've done a risk assessment and it's identified several risks or issues. How do you manage those risks? You know, maybe talk a little bit about what the next step should be.
Sure, Mike. So as I mentioned before, the goal of the risk assessment is to facilitate decision-making, right? So you've identified risks. What do you do? You know, what sort of actions do you take? And, you know, the key here is action, right? You need to do something more than just document what your potential risks are. There are a number of different acronyms or mnemonics that people use for, you know, how you address risks. Most commonly, I see the four typical actions for what you can do when you identify risks are you can avoid the risk by making changes to somehow eliminate, you know, the threat of that risk taking effect. You can control or mitigate a risk by reducing either the impact or likelihood or both of the risk by taking specific steps. You can choose to transfer the risk. You know, you might share it through insurance, right? Or using particular outsourcing or service providers to transfer a portion of the risk off of you. Or you can accept the risk as is, and maybe even budget the cost of, you know, of that risk having been exploited as part of your budgetary process. So the key here, though, like I said, is to do something. Even choosing to accept a risk is doing something. It's making a decision. So I guess my number one takeaway for, you know, what should you do once you've actually identified those risks is to make that decision. And you have to make that decision based on intelligent information. So, you know, what is the actual level of risk based on your specific situation? What sort of countermeasures do you have in place that might impact that risk? What are the regulatory and client requirements like that we kind of touched on the last question? Do you have a particular, if you identify a risk that indicates, you know, you may need to have some controls in place, well, some of those regulatory or even client requirements sometimes are going to include specific controls you already have to have in place anyway. So you may have no choice, depending on the type of risk that you have identified to control it or mitigate it. And also, you know, what's your current budget and project roadmap look like? Is it something that you can mitigate or control against if you do have the budget and time for it? Or is it something that you're going to have to either accept or insure against for now and then maybe address it later?
Great. Thank you. Does anybody else, Kelly or Leslie, do you want to add anything to that in terms of what you think the next step should be after, you know, after we have identified issues or potential issues in a risk assessment?
I think that a consideration may need to be, you know, what types of progress reports have you gotten along the way, and how severe or material are some of the findings going to seem to be? I know in my career, I've been involved in situations where the surveyors or the assessors start to see real opportunities or gaps between what you might expect and what the reality is. And, you know, sometimes when you've made a lot of changes in an organization after a merger, a growth, a downsizing, you know, or some sort of other material change in the way you do business, sometimes people have a habit of reverting back to the way they used to do things, and that creates some risk for you. And so along the way, I think if the assessor starts to realize that there are a number of pretty material things that expose the organization to risk, there may be a time that you would want to begin to address some of what you're finding to your lawyer, inside or outside, and then to try to track things that really, really seem like they might expose the organization, or that the organization may be exposed. You may want to follow a path where you're getting some sort of legal advice to rectify it, to protect some of that information. Other situations might be if you identify some risks related to employees. You know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of litigation over whether collection agencies calculated overtime pay correctly. Now there's a new trend of litigation to go after financial services businesses, including collection agencies, if they have websites that are not Americans with Disabilities Act compliant. If you're doing risk assessments about things like that, where there are known pockets of litigation, you may want to be very cautious about what you're putting in writing and who you're directing it to, because you're probably not going to be able to ignore the results without deepening your risk. I do also think there's a future history to your assessment. A beautiful thing, and I know that in data security, there are principles related to the maturity of your compliance program called PRISMA. But a beautiful thing is to be able to come back a year later and see and feel a sense of accomplishment that you've remediated some of the risks you saw last year, and then test to see if there were unintended consequences, meaning things that you broke by fixing other things. You know, almost like side effects when you take a medication and you think it's fixing one thing and it breaks other stuff. I don't know, Kelly, if you want to comment on that.
I was just going to say right on. It's really important to think about the unintended consequences, and that's one of the reasons why it's helpful to have a good group across the different divisions from your company participating. Because, you know, sometimes if compliance comes up with a solution for one thing and they aren't thinking about it, you know, with all of the possibilities that as a result of that change, you might need, if IT is sitting in the room, IT will say, oh, but if we do that change, it's going to affect, you know, X, Y, and Z. Are you guys thinking about that? You know, because sometimes you're not, which is why, again, it speaks to having everyone sort of participating. One of the things I did want to say is I really liked what you were saying, Mike, about, you know, when you're done, you have this list of your high risks and you're thinking, okay, am I going to control or mitigate this risk? Am I going to transfer this risk? Am I going to accept this risk by budgeting the cost of that risk if it's exploited? That's one of my favorite ways to do something that I want to do, right? If I'm trying to get the board of directors to authorize something, one of the best ways to do it is, okay, if we're not going to, you know, implement this control because we think it's expensive, I want to make sure that we're budgeting for this risk. So I'm going to put out some initial numbers here, because if we're going to get a lawsuit for this, this is our exposure, this is the, you know, maximum sort of recovery. And sometimes when you go through that budgeting it out process and you seek to put that into your budget next year, the cost of adding an additional control mechanism, perhaps by having a new vendor, you know, with a different, you know, communication platform to reach consumers or whatever, is not as, you know, crazy or expensive as they thought before, once they're looking at you budgeting for that risk to actually be exploited by someone. And a lot of times people say, oh, you know, you can never budget for that crazy risk of litigation. Like, who was budgeting for a class action lawsuit on barcodes? Like, nobody ever thought that if you saw barcode through a glassine window that you'd actually be exposed to liability in a class action FDCPA case, right? I mean, I doubt that anybody really predicted that. I'm sure even when the first case came out, people were laughing like, oh, this is ridiculous, right? Now we have a Third Circuit opinion that says that's a violation, right? So, it is possible to budget for litigation exposure. And sometimes when you start to do that, it helps get buy-in from your executive C-level suite, board of directors, on ways that you want to move in terms of compliance controls that you want to put into place as a result of, you know, the risk ratings that you receive after you've completed your risk assessment.
Yeah, and you know, once you've started along that process, lo and behold, you've now graduated from conducting a risk assessment to actually starting to work under a risk management framework and managing those risks on an ongoing basis instead of just, you know, maybe once a year when you update your spreadsheet.
Yep. And, you know, I did say at the beginning that we do the risk assessment once a year, but what I'm it's not like we fill out the spreadsheet and then, oh, we're done, you know, now it's the next step, which actually takes several months, because then you have to meet to evaluate the risks that identified. And you have to, as a team, this is how we do it, at least as a team, you have to come up with your action plan for each particular risk. And that's where we go through the steps that Mike was talking about how are we going to avoid this? Are we going to control and mitigate it? Are we going to transfer it? Are we going to accept it as is? And then what that looks like. So you end up actually having a plan of action for each little risk that you kind of have to follow through. And once you've added an additional control, you have to test that that control is working, right, by auditing it. You have to test that that control doesn't have any unintended consequences, like Leslie was talking about, which is really critical. So it's really a process that never really ends. So by the time you're done implementing your controls, testing them to make sure that they're working, tweaking your changes, documenting everything so that you can show anyone that not only did you identify the risk, but then you changed your policies and procedures to control that risk. You, you know, audited your policies and procedures to make sure that you remediated, right? By the time you're done with all that, it's already time to do your risk assessment for next year.
Yeah. And one thing that we do that I, you know, think is very successful is the 72 rule. 72 hours after you implement a change, you check in with the people affected by it to make sure they really understood it when they got back to their desk and they had to do it. And then 72 days after you make a change, you check in again to make sure that people haven't reverted back to the way they were doing things before, so that whatever action items you prioritize in your risk assessment, once you start taking steps to do something about them, your risk assessment is incomplete if you don't have follow-up steps to make sure that the change you're hoping to bring about is A, understood,
and B, implemented correctly, and then I guess C, implemented in a way that doesn't hose other things up in your organization.
Sorry, just catching up on my notes. All right, we're almost out of time. We've only got a few minutes left. Last chance, anybody, if you've got a type it in now and send it to us, and we'll try to get to it before the top of the hour, and we have to wrap things up. One question, Leslie, I'm curious to get your perspective on, because it seems like a lot of the things we're talking about today, very robust, very comprehensive. How does the size of a collection agency impact conducting a risk assessment? Actually, sorry, Mike, I meant that for you. Sorry, my bad.
Oh, sure, no problem. So, you know, in some cases, whether you're a large or a small agency, you're still gonna want to go through a similar process. Whereas, you know, with a larger agency, you may have 10 people in the room all wearing one hat. In a smaller agency, you might have 3 people in the room, but you know, everyone's wearing 3 hats. But in a nutshell, you're probably going to follow through with a very similar process in terms of, you know, identifying critical assets, identifying the threats that might threaten those assets and the vulnerabilities that might allow those threats to be exploited, that sort of thing. So when it comes down to the actual process that you follow, many of the frameworks that are out there are actually sort of a one-size-fits-all type of framework where you can follow through these and come out with a pretty comprehensive risk assessment regardless of your size. I think the key, though, is to make sure that the person conducting the risk assessment doesn't necessarily have to be, in fact, in some cases, they probably shouldn't be one of the actual decision makers for, you know, what's going to happen as a result of identifying the risks. The person conducting the risk assessment, again, whether this is an internal resource or an external resource, should really be more of a guide or a referee to ensure that the decision makers have all the information they need to determine how to respond to an identified risk. So they can also sort of be the project manager to help track the responses. But in larger organizations, you might have different people or groups for that. But yeah, I mean, I guess in a nutshell, it's pretty much the same process, but you just may have you know, people wearing more hats, I guess, as it were, in terms of identifying risks in their particular area.
Thanks. We got a question here from the audience. Please repeat the resources available that you mentioned. I'm not sure exactly which resources specifically,
sure.
But I would
I think probably, Mike, go ahead and I think it's the niche publications, and
that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess the quickest way to get to them, because you know, navigating the NIST website can be a little bit Byzantine sometimes, is if you just go to something like your favorite search engine, like Google, and if you were to type in NIST, that's N as in National Institute Standards of Technology, NIST, SP stands for Special Publication, 8, and then just the number 800. And the document that I mentioned was SP 800-30, which is a guide to conducting risk assessments. And then Leslie, you mentioned a different one specific for HIPAA, is that right?
Yeah, 800-66. And then Mike, we've both mentioned a number of state data security laws that have risk assessment components. And there is a website, www, N like Nancy, C like Cat, S like Sam, L like legislature.org, NCSL, that keeps a running tally with hyperlinks to all the state's data security laws. So if you just use that same favorite search engine and you go to this site, you'll be able to click on whatever states you want and take a look at what their laws are. And instead of having to shop through state by state by state, they're all accumulated on this particular website.
Awesome. Well, the person who asked the question came in with a thank you, so I think we got it. I appreciate that. But what I'd like to do is ask each of the panelists to maybe share some parting thoughts, words of wisdom, any sort of summary of what they've discussed today. Before we do that, one question just came in. Is voice analytics software a good function to have to lower risk for functions they rely heavily on agents for? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
Sure. This is Kelly. It depends on how you are using CallMiner. So, if you are using CallMiner to listen and identify that your collectors are giving the mini Miranda, are giving the "this is recorded and being monitored" advisal, are doing the verification that you or your clients are requiring, then yes, for each of those specific things, it is a good way to help mitigate your risk if you know that it's working in that way. But it's only good enough to mitigate risk for the risk that you're actually using it to mitigate for, right? So CallMiner can be used in many, many ways, to be listening and analyzing your call and if you're doing it live. So yes, absolutely. But you just have to make sure that when you're doing your risk assessment that you're actually evaluating what you are using CallMiner to control specifically.
Thank you. Now we've reached the top of the hour. So what I'd like to do is go around the panel and ask for some words of wisdom or a summary of what they've talked about today. And Kelly, I'd like to go to you first, please.
Great. So thanks, everyone. I guess the one thing that I would like to add in conclusion would be touching back on, what Leslie had kind of mentioned about when you're creating your risk assessment and these reports, you want to think critically about if you're doing it all inside or if you're bringing someone in from the outside, because one concern that you want to think about is perhaps if you need to keep sort of the results of that risk assessment confidential or attempt to keep them confidential or excluded from discovery. In certain instances, and by bringing in someone from the outside, such as the outside counsel, you might be able to complete your risk assessment as a privileged document. So that's another consideration you want to think about.
Perfect. Thanks, Mike.
Sure. I guess I'd just like to reiterate, just to keep your goal in mind. You're not just going through a risk assessment process to list a bunch of potential issues and then save your spreadsheet up on a file share and look at it again 11 months from now. You really want to enter in a risk management process where you're identifying risks, you are deciding what to do about them, you're following up and managing those risks throughout the year. It really could be a very useful tool to do exactly, what I said the purpose of the risk assessment is earlier in the call, which is to help the business, to facilitate the businesses making decisions based on those risks.
Great, thank you. And Leslie?
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you, Interpros, for sponsoring this today. It's truly a privilege to have the opportunity to be here with Kelly and Mike. One other situation occurred to me where you might want to do a risk assessment, particularly if you're going to use internal resources, would be if you want to enhance the sensitivity of different departments for the activities of other departments, you could give them the task of conducting some version of a risk assessment on departments where they don't want. There's a lot to be said for walking a few miles or hiking them or running them in somebody else's shoes as a way to improve how folks in your company communicate with each other. I think that Mike's point about and Kelly's point about having interdisciplinary teams also can help get that accomplished. So thanks a lot, Mike Gibb, for putting us together, and thanks for finding a great and generous sponsor.
Well, thank you. Before I let everyone go, let me thank Kelly, Leslie, and Mike one last time for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would not have been possible without their participation. I also want to thank InterPros for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.interpros.com to learn more about the company or call 844-224-1135 for more information. Thanks to everybody who signed up and listened and asked questions today. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for more news and more webinars in the very near future. And I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.